Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The ceasefire in Gaza takes effect, but the deadly cost continues to go up. And Ukraine says it is bearing down on rebels in Donetsk. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Foreign ministers from seven nations are calling on the Israeli military and Hamas militants to extend the 12-hour humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, along with diplomats from France, Britain, Germany, Italy, Turkey, and Qatar, are in Paris today to urge a lasting ceasefire to address Israel's concerns about security while also trying to accommodate Palestinian demands to open up economic trade and development in Gaza. On the streets in Israel, both the conflict and reaction to the ceasefire are getting mixed reactions.
Personally, I think everybody is fed up with this situation. I think we've done whatever we need to do, both parties, by the way, not only the Israeli party. And I think we have to end it, and we've finished our business there.
This time, the second time, or the third time maybe, it's like giving another bullet to someone that tried to kill you on the first time and missed.
Palestinian officials say more than 100 bodies have been pulled from the rubble since the truce began, bringing the death toll among Palestinians in this latest conflict to more than 1,000. The United States has evacuated diplomats from Libya and shuttered the embassy in Tripoli because of fighting in the capital. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from Paris.
Secretary Kerry says the United States is suspending diplomatic activities in Libya because of what he calls freewheeling militia violence in Tripoli.
A lot of the violence is around our embassy, but not on the embassy. But nevertheless, it presents a very real risk to our personnel.
Kerry says diplomatic staff were evacuated overland to Tunisia, from where they'll move on to other locations to continue efforts to ease violence in Libya.
We are deeply committed and remain committed to the diplomatic process in Libya.
The security of American personnel in Libya is a sensitive political issue for the Obama administration. Since the 2012 attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi that killed four Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Paris.
Nigeria has stepped up surveillance at its ports and borders following the country's first confirmed death from Ebola virus. The country's health minister says officials are monitoring airports, seaports, and land borders for people arriving who show signs of the deadly virus. He commented on Friday after officials confirmed a man who had died after arriving in Lagos on a flight from Liberia and tested positive for Ebola. The minister said investigators are trying to track down other passengers who were on the nearly three-hour flight from Monrovia. Nigeria now becomes the fourth West African country to confirm the presence of Ebola within its borders. Officials say all 118 passengers and crew are believed to have died when Air Algeria flight AH5017 crash-landed on Mali on Thursday as it made its way from Burkina Faso to Algeria. The investigation is ongoing, but the crash is believed to have been weather-related. Jennifer Lazuda reports from Dakar.
Search teams have begun combing through the wreckage of Air Algeria flight AH5017, which was found Thursday evening in the desert near the Malian town of Gosi, not far from the border of Burkina Faso. Rescuers say there are no signs of survivors, but they have recovered at least one of the plane's black boxes. The plane, which left Ouagadougou shortly after 1 o'clock GMT on Thursday, disappeared from radar about an hour later, after the pilots requested a change in course due to bad weather. Spanish airline Swift Air, which owned the Boeing MD-83 plane, said there were 110 passengers and six crew members on board. Almost half the passengers were French, and most passengers were in transit to Europe, the Middle East, and Canada. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Fighting raged in Ukraine's eastern city of Donetsk today as government troops continued an assault on rebel-held areas. Kyiv's national security spokesman told reporters the troops are bearing down on the regional capital. Echoing similar reports from U.S. officials, Ukrainian officials say that Russia continues massing forces along their eastern border. In Moscow, the Russian Foreign Ministry declared the U.S. responsible for the conflict in Ukraine because of strong support for the Kyiv government. The U.S. has accused Russia of an imminent transfer of Russian arms to Ukrainian separatists and also of continuing to fire artillery across the border into Ukraine. But the U.S. says it has seen no indications that Ukraine has fired into Russia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Fraser.
We are deeply committed and remain committed to the diplomatic process in Libya. Our envoy will continue to be engaged with the British envoy and other envoys, and we will continue to try to build out of the election the legitimacy of the government formation and the efforts to end the violence.
The United States evacuates personnel and suspends diplomatic activity in Libya amidst fighting in the capital, Tripoli.
All the passengers that the patient came in contact with have been traced and are now being investigated in line with the World Health Organization international health regulations.
The Nigerian government confirms a case of Ebola in Lagos.
We have been able to show that we can increase our vitamin A levels 6 times.
And supporters of genetically modified crops argue that this could revolutionize agriculture in Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United States has evacuated diplomats from Libya and closed the embassy in Tripoli because of fighting in the capital. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from Paris.
Secretary Kerry says the United States is suspending diplomatic activities in Libya because of what he calls freewheeling militia violence in Tripoli.
A lot of the violence is around our embassy, but not on the embassy. But nevertheless, it presents a very real risk to our personnel.
Kerry says diplomatic staff were evacuated overland to Tunisia, from where they'll move on to other locations to continue efforts to ease violence in Libya.
We are deeply committed and remain committed to the diplomatic process in Libya. Our envoy will continue to be engaged with the British envoy and other envoys, and we will continue to try to build out of the election the legitimacy of the government formation and the efforts to end the violence. We call on all Libyans to engage in the political process and to come together in order to avoid the violence.
The security of American personnel in Libya is a sensitive political issue for the Obama administration. Since the 2012 attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi that killed 4 Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, the International Criminal Court is investigating the current violence in Libya, some of the worst fighting since the 2011 uprising that toppled longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi. Rival militia are battling for control in Tripoli at a time when a weak central government is riven by divisions between Islamist, tribal, and nationalist factions. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Paris.
Nigerian officials say a man who died in Lagos Friday tested positive for the dreaded Ebola virus. Nigeria's health minister, Onyebuchi Chukwu, said the 40-year-old man was hospitalized after showing Ebola-like symptoms as he arrived on a flight from Monrovia, Liberia on Tuesday.
All the passengers that the patient came in contact with have been traced and are now being investigated. In line with the World Health Organization international health regulations and in keeping with international best practice, all ports of entry to Nigeria, including airports, seaports, and land borders, have been placed on red alert.
Nigeria becomes the 4th West African country to confirm the presence of Ebola, which has killed hundreds of people this year in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The disease has spread despite containment measures by regional health officials, including the isolation of suspected Ebola patients and warnings to avoid any physical contact with those infected by the virus. Cultural practices such as caring for patients at home and family burials for those killed by the disease have undermined containment efforts. The The Overseas Development Institute, ODI, launched a report titled Unhappily Ever After: Slow and Uneven Progress in the Fight Against Early Marriage, that coincided with the first ever Girls' Summit in London, United Kingdom, earlier this week. The lead author of the report, Caroline Hopper, stated that poverty and entrenched discriminatory social and cultural conditions play a role in the early marriage crisis in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. I reached her in London and asked her about the major causes of early marriage.
Obviously, it's linked to poverty, but it's not just linked to poverty. There are many social norms, traditions that people continue to engage in, which means that they want to marry their daughters early. They don't want to invest further in their daughters. So it's a complex range of issues, from poverty, from families not having enough money and not being able to afford to keep girl children in the house, because usually when they marry out of the household into their husband's household. So parents don't want to invest further in girls' education. They would rather they marry from the age of 12 and leave the household, because once they're married, the benefit of their income or any other activities they do won't come back to their household. They'll go to their husband's household.
The report states that while early marriage has declined in some countries, evidence suggests that overall there has been limited progress. Why do you think progress has been so limited?
I think it's because people do not value girls as much as they value boys. And although the economic factors are very important in this, it is because the value of girls is very low and girls have very little power and very little voice. So they don't have the opportunity to get an education. They can't stand up for themselves and their rights are very, very limited. Even when they are married, of course, they fall under the power of their husband's household. And they're not able to own property. They often don't have any custody of their own children. And so they're powerless. So it's very, very difficult to change an institution when the people who are suffering most have no voice.
Why is it important for the nations at large to know about the socioeconomic impact of early marriages?
Well, girls are a huge untapped resource, if you like, for national economies. At the summit that was just held, one of the health ministers from a developing country pointed out that they have invested in health services a great deal, and the delivery of those health services have improved, but they haven't made any progress. And finally, they've realized that probably the reason why their health statistics have not improved is because they're looking at girls who are fundamentally disempowered, and those girls are costing the economy quite a lot of money. I mean, as we know, girls who marry early tend to give birth early, and a 12 to 15 year old girl who gives birth is 5 times more likely to die in childbirth and many, many times more likely to suffer from the devastating health consequences of an early birth that her body's not ready for. That is hugely costly for a country. Countries are also forgoing the income earning potential of girls because they are not getting secondary education and they're not then going on to be economically productive citizens. And also, of course, they're not going on to be politically active citizens, which is a huge loss for any country.
According to the report, in Uganda, girls as young as 12 years old seek relationships with older men, commonly called sugar daddy relationships, due to the lack of any other opportunities and the possibility of much needed material gain. Now, some school of thought might say that this behavior is closely linked to low self-esteem or loose morals. How would you react to that?
I think when you're confronted with a situation in any country where you have no opportunities, where your family is living in poverty, you have to look at what you can do to change the status of your life conditions, your family's poverty and your own poverty. And the girls who do this in Uganda, sometimes they do it willingly. Sometimes their families push them to get involved. All of them are looking for an opportunity beyond the poverty that they live in. And they are young, they have little life experience, and they often think that they are going to gain more than they actually do. What usually happens is they enter these liaisons, they end up pregnant and outside of marriage, which is worse than them being in some sort of protective framework of marriage. And so they're left on their own very young with babies. This is far worse than any other situation or any other outcome.
Caroline Harper is the head of ODI's Social Development Programme. She spoke with me from London, United Kingdom. The United States aims to partner with several African countries for the long term, but some of these nations need electricity to do so. U.S. President Barack Obama first addressed the continent's lack of electricity a year ago with his Power Africa initiative aimed at making power more accessible. VOA's Vincent McCoy spoke with the chairman of UN Energy and former Director General of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, Dr. Kande Yumkela, and asked him whether President Obama's Power Africa initiative and the UN Energy complement each other or are fundamentally different in approaching the issue of energizing Africa.
They complement each other very much. President Obama identified energy access as a major input into Africa's economic diversification and economic prosperity initiatives. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also identified energy access as a means of prosperity and a means for achieving Millennium Development Goals in all developing countries, particularly in Africa, where the energy poverty problem is more entrenched. Yeah. And of course, Africa loses quite a bit already because of lack of energy. I give you a number, 2 to 3% of GDP is lost because of unreliable energy. But you also have almost 800,000 premature deaths due to people using charcoal and firewood or cow dung for their primary energy needs. And of course, household air pollution because of those energy sources.
Now, what are the most viable energy sources in Africa and how can they be maximized to the maximum benefit of the continent? It's a vast continent.
It is a vast continent. But you can look at a number of solar radiation maps. It has probably some of the highest solar radiation exposure than any other continent. So there is a huge opportunity for solar power, a lot of rivers that can be harnessed for hydropower, and of course biomass for bioenergy. But in particular, remember that Africa also, in the last 5 years, 30% of the oil and gas discoveries were on that continent. And so you can see that this continent has significant amount of energy resources. Question is, how do we harness them? How do we integrate them with available technologies and to make energy access a reality for all Africans?
Very quickly, to what extent do you notice that African nations actually prioritize the issue of energizing the continent in terms of policy?
Oh, it's become a real issue now for a number of leaders. In fact, I am on my way to Abidjan and Burkina Faso to meet with the heads of states and their ministers in those countries. Africans feel the impact of lack of energy. In some of those countries like Burkina Faso or Liberia, Africans are already paying 38, 40 or 50 cents per kilowatt hour compared to 4 and 7 cents in other parts of the world. So the African leaders from Ethiopia to Rwanda to Cote d'Ivoire to Sierra Leone to Liberia, they've all prioritized energy. Well, the challenges are there. How do they formulate the right policies to crowd in investments? Mm-hmm. How do they de-risk those investments? And of course, the technologies that are needed to be deployed.
Dr. Kande Yumkela is the chairman of UN Energy. He spoke with Vincent McCoy from London, United Kingdom. Millions of Muslims worldwide are currently observing the holy month of Ramadan through prayers and various activities. In a nation like Zimbabwe, where the majority of people either follow the Christian religion or traditional beliefs, not much is known about Ramadan and Muslim beliefs. In this first edition of a three-part series on the holy month of Ramadan and Muslim beliefs, we look at fasting, which is one of the five pillars of Islam. Toghai Shava reports for VOA from the Midlands capital, Gweru.
This year started on June 28th and is expected to end July 28th in most parts of the world. Ramadan is the ninth month of the Muslim calendar year, during which strict fasting is observed from sunrise to sunset until the month ends with a feast called Eid al-Fitr. Ramadan began as a holy month when the first Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad on what is known as the Night of Power. According to the Islamic Society of Rutgers University, fasting in the holy month involves abstaining from food, drink, and smoking. It is also about self-restraint and bringing followers closer to Allah. The call to prayer, which is performed to mark the start of five prayer sessions undertaken by Muslims a day, becomes more significant during the holy month of Ramadan. Ali Mack is an imam or preacher at the Mosque of Light in Kwekwe. Mack, who became an imam after completing a 5-year course at the Islamic College in Harare, says Ramadan is one of the 5 pillars of the religion.
This Ramadan is the 9th month on the Islamic calendar, and it was made compulsory for each and every mature Muslim, male or female, to fast for 29 or 30 days. This is an order from God Almighty. He has said in the holy book of the Muslims, the Quran, that kutiba alaykum ya ayyuhalladhina amanu kutiba alaykumusiyamu kama kutiba alalladhina min qablikum la'allakum tattaqun, that all you who believe, fasting has been prescribed upon you just as how it was prescribed upon those who were before you, for the main reason that we may gain taqwa, that is the fear of God Almighty.
The other pillars of Islam are prayer, faith, pilgrimage, and zakat, which means everything belongs to God and wealth is held by human beings in trust. In most cases, Muslims hold their prayers in mosques, and this includes during the month of Ramadan. In Harare, they gather at the Islamic Center in Waterfalls, and in Belvedere, while in the Midlands capital, Gweru, they congregate at the Gweru Islamic Center. In Kwekwe, they assemble at the Mosque of Light, which is situated in the city's central business district. Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, is also home to hundreds of Muslims, mostly drawn from Malawian immigrants. Gweru resident, Mrs. Yasmin Milanzi, grew up in a Christian family, but later converted to Islam. She says many people have a lot of misconceptions about Islam and strongly believes that this can be dispelled if they take some time to know more about their religion. Like her colleagues, she's currently observing Ramadan. Mrs. Milanzi explains that a typical day of fasting begins with a light meal known as suhoor, which is eaten before dawn. The day ends with gathering at a mosque for a sunset prayer, the recital of the Quran, and dinner. Mrs. Milanzi says the end of Ramadan is marked by almsgiving and some festivities which are almost similar to Christmas.
Ramadan goes for about 29 days, sometimes it's 30 days. So after those 30 days, that's when we celebrate. We call it Eid al-Fitr. That's when we will be happy celebrating that we finished fasting. So we buy clothes for our kids, the whole family. We buy presents also for each other. We go to the mosque to celebrate with others, that's to encourage unity. We cook different types of food. We don't eat pork. Our meat is halal, it means permissible. We don't drink alcohol or anything that is alcoholic.
19-year-old Asim Milanzi is a young Muslim. She says contrary to some beliefs, Islam is not a religion with strict rules. She says the religion fosters moral uprightness, especially among young people.
Islam is not a strict religion. When they think about the religion, most people focus on the way female Muslims dress and they criticize this. But as a young Muslim, I feel that the dressing is cool because it is decent. Some young girls wear skimpy or tight dresses and they go out in semi-naked state, which is not good. And I believe that the banning of the mixing of boys and girls during prayer and other activities like workshops is also good because it limits the temptation of engaging in premarital sex.
Another 19-year-old youth who only identified himself as Imran is also a follower of Islam. He agrees with the view that the holy month of Ramadan also enforces discipline among the youths. There are an estimated 1.6 billion Muslims around the world, making Islam the world's second largest religious tradition after Christianity, according to the December 2012 Global Religious Landscape Report from the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life. The Pew Research Analysis notes that nearly two-thirds of Muslims live in the Asia-Pacific region. The research indicates that more Muslims live in India and Pakistan, where there are 344 million followers, than in the entire Middle East North Africa region with 317 million. Local Islamic groups have put the number of Muslims in Zimbabwe at 1.2 million. But some researchers and various organizations believe that there are less than 100,000 Muslims in the country, which is dominated by Christianity and local traditional beliefs. Reporting from Gweru, this is Taurai Shava.
A new report states that genetically modified crops, also known as GM crops, would dramatically improve agriculture in Africa. The report published by the policy group Chatham House argues the technology is being held back by scaremongering from opponents. Henny Ridgewell reports for VOA from London.
Inside a temperature-regulated laboratory, scientists in Uganda are developing what they call a golden banana, more hardy and with higher levels of vitamins and minerals. Priva Namanya is one of the researchers.
We have been able to show that we can increase our vitamin A levels 6 times.
Genetically modified or GM crops offer the best hope of increasing productivity and coping with climate change in Africa, according to the co-author of the Chatham House report, Rob Bailey.
There's a whole host of GM crops in development in Africa, specifically designed to address the needs of poor farmers and poor food consumers. Crops like cassava, sorghum, bananas, sweet potato, drought-tolerant maize. And it's precisely these crops that are stuck at the field trial stage.
The reason, says Bailey, is that governments are reluctant to approve GM crops in the face of intense lobbying by opponents.
They've created anti-GM campaigns based on misinformation. So, for example, alleging a link between GM crops and infertility or cancer or animal deformities, none of which is true. There's no evidence for any of this.
Opponents argue GM crops are expensive to produce, do not bring higher yields, and introduce more chemicals into the environment. And they say companies promoting GM crops are more interested in profits than in helping poor farmers produce food. On the outskirts of the Ghanaian capital, Accra, farmer Tete Nati grows pawpaw, maize and other vegetables alongside a small dairy business. This year, Ghana approved field trials for GM grains like cowpeas. Nati thinks it's a bad idea.
And anything that is not natural, it has got its bad sides. You know it. Yes, if it is not natural, then be very careful. Be very careful of it. Because at the end of the day, we start taking GM products. But who has done the research?
Ghana's government insists it has put in place stringent biosafety laws. But increasing yields through GM crops is not the answer to food shortages in Africa, says Soren Ambrose of ActionAid.
But in fact, it's not so much the problem of producing food as it is the problem of getting the food that is produced to the people who need it. But the continent is very much still struggling with its road infrastructure, with its storage facilities for agricultural products and so on.
Millions of small-scale farmers contribute to African agriculture. Campaigners like Bernard Guri of Ghana's Center for Indigenous Knowledge fear the introduction of GM crops could drive those farmers out of business.
This is against our sovereignty. It is another form of colonialism where gradually the developed world is conspiring to take over our whole food system in terms of taking over our land, taking over our seed, and taking over the whole farming food system.
But if one African country did approve GM crops, others would quickly follow, says Rob Bailey of Chatham House.
It would become apparent to farmers that they're very useful, that they're potentially more high-yielding, that they have resistance to pests or diseases, and that consumers can see that they're not actually a threat to their health, then that could unlock a positive chain and you could see GM crops being taken up elsewhere.
Supporters of GM crops argue they could trigger a green revolution in African agriculture, but there are still many who remain unconvinced. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Still to come in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Yes, in bed, too. All red, cheese. Benz Petrol, le cadet de Loke Jazz, savant de la RDC. Godé Apula, maman na bébé l'or, Christelle na Priscilla, Banama Passa. Matala Narota.
Sima o pesinga mbote ya loboko chacho. Pese na yo ya monoko bombeli na nimbala. Bon anniversaire na yo kosu etenga. Olo biasa lilo bate o Miami seta nginga na susi.
Chacho senge na ngana mingana. Masala na operasyon mi bale. Soya bolingo na yo chacho mbala. Operation ya mi bale mémoire ya ko comprendre yo. Soki minganga ba boy batianga sonde ya ba mauvaise. Nanzoto nangai Marie Pauline Tupa.
Sima o pesinga mbote ya loboko chacho. Pese na yo ya monoko bombeli na nimbala. Bon anniversaire na yo kosu etenga. Olo biasa lilo bate o Miami seta nginga na susi.
Sashe ya mai bako zongi sanga na nzoto. Eza leboke ya Miami so ya ba mure desu.
José Mataba.
Sima o pesinga mbote ya loboko chacho. Pese na yo ya monoko bombeli na nimbala. Bon anniversaire na yo kosu etenga. Olo biasa lilo bate o Miami seta nginga na susi.
Bintou Ngimbi, le grand japonais de Bruxelles. Wati Vie Mungé. Artiste photo, l'image d'or. Micro autorisé, Rufungu Tanganga. Bienvenue Bongolo, Ok Lokoyo. Jacques Kichinja, André Sumbu na Rotterdam.
Chachomba lo langui singaye na
bolingo na ya butuhe bolingo etonda avec son boye na nuna zwate utana botama na ligumu ya mama e
Tonino Fernando
na bosa na kombo ya chacho mbala na monoko na koma kopenga ye chifre 3 na ndoto na lota kibakola kisanga elimbo ya chifre 3 na yebite soki mikolo misato e sanza misato tompe mbula misato obandeko
joli mwadi
na keiko tuna oje peplasi dan soso la mwali kambo e alobi na kota reteta mikolo misato e jamba na kisanga ntina ya elimbo yango na keiko tuna alfonse mavela soso la mwali kambo e alobi na kota reteta mikolo misato e jamba na kisanga ntina ya elimbo yango retrete na kanaka Lelo yompona molingo na yo Ikolo misa tokoli ate komelate Epe singa pasi na estoma Suka na mona dokotolo Ya solo dokotolo akosili sa pasi ya estoma Kasi ya motemate Nambeto alopitalo vizite nanga kaka Elili na yo chacho mbala
Sele Chimpi, la Saoudienne. Badive, Fulampungu. Ize Mate.
Na keiko tunariki madaga soso la mwali kamboe. Alobi na kota retetra mikolo misatoe. Dambala kisanganti na ya elembo. Yango. Na keiko tuna oje peplasida soso la mwali kamboe. Alobina kota retreta mikolo misato e Zambala kisanganti na yalikambo yango Retrete na kanaka kokota telelo yompona molingo na yo Mikolo misato kolia te komelate Epe singa pasi na estoma Suka na mona dokotolo Ya solo dokotolo akosili sa pasi ya estoma Kasi ya motemate Na meto alopitalo vizite na ngakaka Elili na yo chato mbala ye
And that was music from the continent. Now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Here's Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure to take time out and share my reflections on American attitude towards Africa. Particularly, I want to look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. Every passing week, I pay a great deal of time to the headlines in Africa, and I also like to see how Americans are covering African issues. As we move towards August, when the president summoned 47 African states to attend the White House Summit on Africa, the leaders from these countries are expected to be in town next month, and they are going to have some serious conversation with the American leadership with regard to Africa in the American agenda, all this put all away. America in the African agenda. The African leaders just came out of Malabo in Equatorial Guinea, where they held their annual African Head of State Summit. There, they look on a wide range of issues. And of course, one point which many people are observing that event is the question of agriculture. Are these people paying adequate attention to agriculture and development in Africa? It looks as if many of the African countries are so lulled by this oil boom and money from oil that they historically neglected agriculture. Nigeria is a good example of this phenomenon, where Nigerians used to produce a lot of cash crops during the colonial period, and people used to feed themselves with their own agricultural product. But because of the oil boom, we saw a complete reversal of policies on agriculture. And of course, they tried to solve that problem after Gowon, and of course, Obasanjo. And then you had Tewusagari, who tried to bring a green revolution. It was supposed to be a Nigerian reaction to the phenomena, as was done by the Indians and the Chinese. At that particular time, we have that problem. Today, when Obama invites the African leaders, the central point for him is Power Africa. This is based on a logic deriving from two arguments. One is Africa cannot join the League of Nations without industrialization. Africans must industrialize. This is the magic number of Obama. He feels that he can introduce Power Africa and hopefully inspire a large number of African leaders to begin to develop power resources in their continent. Of course, Tanzanians who have natural gas are benefiting from this deal. The African countries that were exporting oil, like Nigeria and Angola, benefited from Angola. Now, Power Africa is supposed to give an elevator for all of the others to join the bandwagon towards industrialization. So if we're talking about what Obama's legacy is all about, we have to talk about power, stupid. With power, stupid, and with the resurrection of AGOA, the Africans may be able to have power to produce light industries as China is doing with dollar stores across the United States. The Africans, particularly those from Mauritius and Lesotho who benefited from Angola 1, may begin to do something else. That's one of the reasons why agriculture becomes fundamental. The Africans must do with agriculture what the Chinese and Indians have done. And if they do it right, they will be able to feed themselves. And this way, the politics of the belly will be addressed. But most importantly, the politics of the head would be addressed. That's the question. How can Africans come to Washington, engage the American leadership, and develop a new platform of communication with America? Power as central, AGOA as an important item, and then most fundamentally, the destiny of African youth. The destiny of African youth. Whether they were resident adequately in Malabo or not, or whether they will be properly represented to the initiative of President Obama, that is the bottom line. Agriculture, industrialization, and mobilization of African youth. That's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Niang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Adette Frazier. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In one of the most blatant violations to date of their June 10th pledge to end the fighting and enter talks to establish a transitional government, South Sudanese rebels attacked and are seeking control of Nasser, a strategic town in Upper Nile State. Opposition forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar launched a ground attack against the South Sudanese army early July 20th, capturing some government positions. Army spokesmen claimed that the rebels were eventually driven away with heavy losses. Sporadic fighting is said to continue around the area. The parties have repeatedly agreed to negotiate to end the fighting, only to see it continue. Prodded by the regional bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, as well as by the threat of sanctions by the African Union, United States, and others in the international community, both sides agreed to an August 10th deadline for formation of a transition government, and progress on this front is urgently needed. Meanwhile, the conflict is in its seventh month. Thousands are dead, and more than 1.5 million people have been driven from their homes. Food stocks are running low in northern regions of the country, where the fighting has been fiercest, and aid agencies fear South Sudan could tip into famine. The United States strongly condemns the attack on Nasser and calls on both parties to immediately end all such actions and fully adhere to their previous truce agreements. With the destruction inflicted on Nasser, the repeated suffering of South Sudan's people, and the worsening humanitarian crisis, it is increasingly urgent that both parties immediately recommit themselves to inclusive political negotiations. The cycle of violence that has plagued South Sudan for too long must come to an end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.